This is disc number 3.
Filled with the rage from the sword in his fist and his own impassioned anger at what he was seeing, Richard ignored Nikki. If there was anyone left alive, he had to find them. "There's no one left," Nikki murmured, as if in answer to his thoughts. If the threat still lurked nearby, he needed to know.
"Who could have done this?"
Victor whispered, clearly not interested in leaving until he had the guilty party in his grip. "It doesn't look like anything human," Kara answered in quiet indictment. As Richard stepped carefully through the remains, the silence of the shrouding woods pressed in on him like a great weight. No birds called, no bugs buzzed, no squirrels chattered. The muting effect of the heavy overcast and drizzle only served to thicken the hush. Blood dripped from leaves, branches, and the tips of bent grasses. The trunks of trees were splattered with it. The coarse bark of an ash was smeared with oozing tissue. A hand, fingers open and slack, empty of any weapons, lay palm up on a gravel slope beneath the large leaves of a mountain maple. Richard spotted the footprints of where they had all entered the area, and some of his own footprints were where he had left only a short time ago with Nikki, Kara, and Victor. Many of the remains lay in virgin forest where none of them had walked. There were no peculiar footprints among the carnage, although there were unexplained places where the ground had been ripped open. Some of those gouges cut right through thick roots. Taking a better look, Richard realized that the plowed gashes were places where men had been smashed to the ground with such violence that it had torn open the forest floor. In some spots, flesh still clung to the exposed ends of splintered roots. Kara gripped his shirt at the shoulder, trying to urge him back. "Lord Rawl, I want you away from here." Richard pulled his shoulder free of her grip. "Quiet!" As he stepped silently among the remains, the countless voices of those who had used the sword in the past whispered in the back of his mind. "Don't focus on what you're seeing, on what is done. Watch for what caused it and might yet come. Now is the time for vigilance." Richard hardly needed such a warning. He was gripping the wire-wound hilt of the sword so tightly that he could feel the raised lettering of the word truth formed by gold wire woven through the silver. That golden word bit into the flesh of his palm on one side and his fingertips on the other. At his feet, a man's head stared up at him from among scrub sumac. A mute cry twisted the expression fixed on his face. Richard knew him. His name had been Nuri. All that this young man had learned, all that he had experienced, all that he had planned for, the world he had begun to make for himself, was ended. For all these men, the world was finished. The one life they had was gone forever. The agony of that terrible loss, that ghastly finality, threatened to extinguish the rage from the sword and swamp him in sorrow. All these men were loved and cherished by those waiting for them to return. Each one of these individuals would be grieved over with heartache that would indelibly mark the living. Richard made himself move on. Now was not the time to grieve. Now was the time to find the guilty and visit upon them retribution and justice before they had the chance to do this to others. Only then could the living mourn for these precious souls lost. Despite how widely he searched, Richard didn't see a single body, not a body in the sense of a whole, recognizable person. Yet the entire area where the men had been waiting was littered with their remains. The surrounding woods also revealed parts of those remains as if some of the men had tried to run. If that was the case, none had gotten far. As Richard moved through the trees looking for any tracks that might help him identify who had killed these men, he kept one eye on the shadows off in the mist. He saw tracks of men who had run, but he saw no tracks chasing after them. As he came around an ancient pine, he was confronted by the top half of a man's chest hanging upside down from a splintered limb. The remains hung well above Richard's head. What was left of the armless torso had been impaled on the stump of a broken limb as if it were a meat hook. The face was fixed with unbridled terror. Being upside down, the hair, dripping blood, stood out straight from the scalp, as if frozen in fright.
"Dear spirits," Victor whispered. Rage twisted his face. "That's Varen."
Richard scanned the area but saw nothing moving in the shadows. "Whatever happened here, I don't think anyone escaped." He noticed that on the ground where Farron's blood dripped, there were no tracks. Kalin's tracks were gone as well. The pain, the horror of wondering if this might be the same thing that had happened to Kalin nearly buckled his knees. Not even the sword's rage was enough to shield him from the agony of that pain. Nikki, close behind him, leaned close.
"Richard," she said in a near whisper, "we need to get out of here."
Kara leaned in beside Nikki.
"I agree."
Victor lifted his mace.
"I want those who did this."
His knuckles were white around the steel grip.
"Can you track them?"
he asked Richard.
"I don't think that would be a good idea," Nikki said.
"Good idea or not," Richard told them, "I don't see any tracks." He looked into Nikki's blue eyes. "Perhaps you would like to try to convince me that I am imagining this as well?" She didn't break eye contact with him, but she didn't answer his challenge either. Victor gazed up at Farron.
"I told his mother that I'd watch over him. What am I going to say to his family now?"
Tears of rage and hurt glistened in his eyes as he pointed with the mace back to the rest of the remains.
"What am I going to say to their mothers and wives and children?"
"That evil murdered them," Richard said. "That you will not rest until you know justice is done. That vengeance will be had." Victor nodded, his anger flagging, misery now filling his voice.
"We have to bury them."
"No,"
Nikki said with grim authority. "As much as I understand your want to care for them, your friends are no longer here, among these pieces of wrecked bodies. Your friends are now with the good spirits. It is up to us not to join them."
Victor's anger resurfaced. "But we must."
"No," Nikki snapped. "Look around. This was a blood frenzy. We don't want to get caught in it. We can't help these men. We need to get out of here."
Before Victor could argue, Richard leaned close to the sorceress.
"What do you know about this?"
"I told you before, Richard, that we needed to talk, but this is not the time or place to do it."
"I agree," Kara growled. "We need to get away from here."
Looking from the remains of Farron back to the bloody mess beneath the maple, Richard suddenly felt a sense of overwhelming loneliness. He wanted Kalin so bad it hurt. He wanted her comfort. He wanted her safe. The agony of not knowing if she was alive and well was unbearable.
"Kara is right," Nikki urgently gripped Richard's arm. "We don't know enough about what we're up against, but whatever did all this, I fear that as weak as you are, your sword can't protect us from it. And right now, neither can I. If it's still in these woods, now is not the time to confront it. Justice and vengeance need us to see them done. To do that, we must be alive."
With the back of a hand, Victor wiped tears of grief and anger from his cheek.
"I hate to admit it, but I think Nikki's right."
"Whatever was looking for you, Lord Rawl," Kara said, "I don't want you here if it should happen to return." Richard noted the way Kara, in her red leather, no longer seemed out of place in the woods. She blended right in with all the blood. Still not ready to abandon the search for whatever had killed these men, and with a dark sense of alarm rising within him, Richard frowned at the moored Sith. "What makes you think it was after me?"
"I told you,"
Nikki said through gritted teeth, answering in Kara's stead.
"Now is not the time, and this is not the place to talk about it. There is nothing we can hope to accomplish here. These men are beyond our help."
Beyond help. Was Kalin beyond help as well? He couldn't allow himself to believe that. He looked north. Richard didn't know where to search for her. Just because the rock that had been kicked out of its resting place had been found to the north of their camp didn't mean that whoever took Kalin went that way.
They might have simply gone north, trying to avoid contact with Victor and his men, and with the soldiers guarding the supply convoy. They might have only been trying to avoid being spotted until they got out of the immediate area. After that, they could have gone anywhere. But where? Richard knew that he needed help. He tried to think of who could help him with something like this. Who would believe him? Zed might believe him, but Richard didn't think his grandfather could offer the specific kind of help he needed in this circumstance. It was awfully far to go if it ended up that Zed's abilities didn't fit this particular kind of problem. Who would be willing to help him, and who might know something? Richard turned suddenly to Victor. Where can I get horses? I need horses. Where's the closest place? Victor was taken off guard by the question. He let the heavy mace hang, and with his other hand wiped rainwater back off his forehead as he considered the question. His brow bunched back up.
Altarang would probably be the closest place, he said after a moment's thought.
Richard slid his sword back into its sheath. Let's go. We need to hurry. Pleased with the decision to leave, Kara gave him a helpful shove in the direction of Altarang. Suspicion lurked in Nikki's eyes, but she was so relieved to have him start away from the sight of so much death that she didn't ask why he wanted horses. Weariness forgotten, the four of them hurried away from men beyond any help. As heartsick as they felt about leaving, each of them understood that it would be too dangerous to stay to try to bury these men. A burial of the dead was not worth the risk to their lives. With his sword put away, the anger extinguished. In its place welled up the crushing pain of grief for the dead. The forest seemed to weep with them. Worse yet was the dread of wondering what could have happened to Kaelin. If she was in the hands of this evil... Think of the solution, Richard reminded himself. If he was to find her, he would need help. To get help, he needed horses. That was the immediate problem at hand. They still had half a day of daylight. He intended not to waste a moment of it. Richard led them away through the tangled woods at an exhausting pace. No one complained. Chapter 7. In the deepening gloom of approaching nightfall, Richard and Kara used thin, wiry pine tree roots they'd pulled up from the spongy ground to lash together the trunks of small trees. Victor and Nikki foraged the understory along the base of the heavily forested slope, cutting and collecting balsam boughs. As Richard held the logs together, Kara tied off the rope-like root. Richard cut the excess for use elsewhere and slipped the knife back into its sheath at his belt. Once he had the log framework securely in place against an overhang of rock, he started stacking the balsam boughs along the bottom. Kara tied random branches on from inside to keep them all in place for the night as Richard continued layering more up the poles. Victor and Nikki dragged armfuls of boughs close to keep him supplied as he worked. The area under the overhanging roof of rock was dry enough. It just wasn't large enough. The lean-to would expand the shelter so as to provide a snug place to sleep. Without a fire, it wouldn't be especially warm, but at least it would be dry. Throughout the day, the drizzle had turned to a slow, steady rain. While they had been on the move, they had been warm enough because of their exertion. But now that they had to stop for the night, the inexorable embrace of the cold had begun. Even in chilly weather, that wasn't truly cold, being wet sapped a person of their necessary warmth and thus their strength. Richard knew that, over time, constant exposure to even mildly chilly wet weather could steal enough vital heat from the body to severely debilitate and sometimes even kill a person. With as little sleep as he knew Nikki and Kara had gotten over the previous 3 days, and in his own weakened condition, Richard recognized that they needed a dry, warm place to get some rest, or they would all be in trouble. He couldn't allow anything to slow him down. For the whole of the afternoon and evening, they had set a steady, rapid pace on their march toward Altarang. After the brutal slaughter of the men, the four of them hadn't been particularly hungry, but they knew that they had to eat if they were to have the strength for the journey. So they nibbled on dried meats and travel biscuits as they made their way through the trackless wilderness. Richard was so exhausted he could hardly stand. Both to cut the distance and to avoid being spotted by anyone, he had guided the others through dense forest, most of it tough going and all of it well off any trails. It had been a grueling day's travel. His head ached. His back ached. His legs ached. If they started early and kept up the strenuous pace, though, they might be able to reach Alterang in one more day's travel. After they got horses, the going would be easier as well as swifter. He wished he didn't need to go so far, but he didn't know what else to do. He couldn't spend forever searching the vast forests all around, on the off chance he would find another rock that had been disturbed, so that he then might have an idea of which direction Kalin had gone. He might never find another such rock, and even if he did, there was no reason to believe that if he kept going in that direction, he would find Kalin. Whoever took her might change direction without ever again disturbing a rock in a way that he would find it. Their regular tracks were gone. Richard knew no way to track someone when magic had made their tracks vanish. Nikki's gift wasn't able to help. Wandering around aimlessly wasn't going to solve anything. As reluctant as he was to leave the area where he had last seen Kalin, Richard didn't think that he had any other choice but to go for help. He went through the motions of building the shelter without giving the work much thought. In the failing light, Kara, concerned for his well-being, kept watching him out of the corner of her eye. She looked like she expected him to fall over at any moment, and if he did, she intended to catch him. As he worked, Richard mulled over the remote but real possibility that Imperial Order soldiers might be searching the woods for them. At the same time, he fretted about what could have killed all of Victor's men and might now be chasing them. He considered what other precautions he might take, and he deliberated over how he would fight whatever could have done such violence. Through it all, he kept trying to think of where Kalin might be. He went over everything he could remember. He brooded over whether or not she was hurt. He agonized over what he might have done wrong. He imagined that she must be filled with fear and doubt, wondering why he wasn't coming to help her escape, why he hadn't yet found her, and if he ever would before her captors killed her. He struggled to banish from his mind the gnawing fear that she might already be dead. He tried not to think about what might be done to her as a captive that could be infinitely more gruesome than a simple execution. Jagang had ample reason to want her to live a good long time. Only the living could feel pain. From the beginning, Kalin had been there to frustrate Jagang's ambitions and sometimes even reverse his success. The Imperial Order's very first expeditionary force in the New World, among other things, slaughtered all the inhabitants of the great Galleon city of Ebenicia. Kalin came upon the grisly sight shortly after a troop of young Galleon recruits had discovered it. In their blind rage, despite being outnumbered 10-1, those young men had been bent on the glory of vengeance and victory, on meeting upon the battlefield the soldiers who had tortured, raped, and murdered all of their loved ones. Kalin came across those recruits, led by Captain Bradley Ryan, just before they were about to march into a textbook battle that she realized would be their death. In their bold inexperience, they were convinced that they could make such tactics work and snatch victory, despite being overwhelmingly outnumbered. Kalin knew how the experienced Imperial Order soldiers fought. She knew that if she allowed those young recruits to do as they planned, they would be marching into a merciless meat grinder and all of them would die. The results of their short-sighted notions of the righteous glory of combat would be that those Imperial Order soldiers would then go on, unopposed, to other cities and continue to murder and plunder innocent people. Kalin took command of the young recruits and set about dissuading them of their ignorant notions of a fair fight. She brought them to fully understand that their only goal was killing the invaders. It didn't matter how the Galleons came to stand over the corpses of those brutes. It only mattered that they did. In that undertaking of killing, there was no glory. There was simply survival. They were killing so that there could be life. Kalin taught those recruits what they needed to know about fighting a force that greatly outnumbered them, and she shaped them into men who could accomplish the grim task. The night before leading those young men into combat, Kalin went alone into the enemy camp and killed their wizard along with some of the officers. The next day, those 5,000 young men fought at her side, followed her instructions, learned from her, and along the way took terrible casualties. But they eventually killed every last one of the Imperial Order's 50,000 men advance force. It had been an accomplishment rarely equaled in history. That had been the first of many blows Kalin struck against Jagang. In answer, he sent assassins after her. They failed. In Richard's absence, after Nikki had taken him away to the heart of the old world, Kalin had gone to join Zed and the Daharan Empire forces. She found them dispirited and on the run after having lost a 3-day battle. In Richard's place, carrying the Sword of Truth, the Mother Confessor pulled the army back onto its feet and immediately counterattacked, surprising the enemy and bloodying them. She brought backbone and fire to the Daharan forces. She inspired them to the challenge. Captain Ryan's men arrived to join with her in the fight against a gang's invading horde. For nearly a year, Kalin led the Daharan Empire forces as they frustrated Jagang's efforts to swiftly subdue the New World. She harried and harassed him without pause. She helped direct plans that resulted in Jagang's army losing hundreds of thousands of men. Kalin had bled the Imperial Order army and helped grind them to a halt outside Adendrill. In winter, she had evacuated the people of Adendrill and had the army take them over the passes into Dahara. The Daharan forces then sealed off those passes and, for the time being, held the Imperial Order at bay short of their final objective of conquering Dahara and finally bringing the New World under the brutal rule of the Fellowship of Order. Jagang's hatred for Kalin was exceeded only by his hatred for Richard. Most recently, the Dreamwalker had sent an extremely dangerous wizard named Nicholas after them. Richard and Kalin had only narrowly escaped capture. Richard knew that the Order relished seeing to it that captured foes suffered monstrous abuse. And there was no one other than Richard, whom Emperor Jagang wanted to put to torture more than the Mother Confessor. There were no lengths to which he would not go to get his hands on her. Emperor Jagang would reserve for Kalin the most unspeakable torture. Richard realized that he was standing frozen, trembling, his fingers gripping a fistful of balsam boughs. Kara silently watched him. He knelt and again started laying the branches in place while struggling to put terrible thoughts from his mind. Kara went back to her work. He put all his effort into concentrating on the task of completing their shelter. The sooner they got to sleep, the more rested they would be when they woke, and the faster they could travel. Even though they were nowhere near any roads and a great distance from the trails, Richard still didn't want to have a fire for fear that scouting soldiers might spot it. Although they wouldn't be able to see the fire's smoke through all the drizzle and fog, such weather tended to keep smoke low to the ground, drifting this way and that through the woods, so any Imperial Order patrols would be able to smell it. It was a real enough possibility that none of the others argued for a fire. Being cold was a lot better than having to fight for their lives. Nikki dragged an armful of balsam boughs close as Richard continued to weave them up the lean-to. None of the others spoke, apparently absorbed in worry that whatever had killed the men might be out there, among the deepening shadows, hunting the four of them as they prepared to go to sleep in a fortress made of nothing more than balsam boughs. Their first day's journey toward Alterang had felt less like traveling and more like running for their lives. But whatever had killed Victor's men had not chased them. At least, Richard didn't think it had. He couldn't really imagine that whatever had the power to kill that many men in such a brutal fashion couldn't manage to catch up with them if it had their trail. Especially not something filled with a blood frenzy, as Nikki had described it. Besides, when he was in the woods, Richard usually knew when there were animals about, and where they likely were, and, as a rule, he knew when people were close. Had Victor and his men not been camped quite so far from Richard, Kalin, and Kara's camp, he would have known they were there. He also had a keen sense of when he was being pursued and if someone was following his trail. As a guide, he sometimes tracked people lost in the woods. He and other guides sometimes had contests to track one another. Richard knew how to watch for someone tracking him. This, however, was less a matter of suspecting that someone was following them and more a feeling of icy dread, as if they were being chased by a murderous phantom in a blood frenzy. That fear constantly urged them to run. He knew, too, that running was often the trigger that made a predator pounce. Richard realized, though, that it was only his imagination making him feel the hot breath of pursuers. Zed had taught him that it was always important to understand why you had specific feelings, so that you could decide if those feelings were caused by something that warranted attention or something that didn't. Other than the palpable fear caused by the brutality of the slaughter, Richard had no evidence that they were being chased, so he tried to keep the emotion in proper perspective. Fear itself often proved to be the greatest threat. Fear made people do thoughtless things that often got them into trouble. Fear made people stop thinking. When they stopped thinking, they often made foolish choices. Several times when he was growing up, Richard had tracked people who had gotten lost in the vast forests around Heartland. One boy Richard had tracked for 2 days kept running in the dark until he eventually fell from a cliff. Luckily, it wasn't a long fall. Richard found him at the bottom of the steep bank with a twisted ankle that was swollen but not broken. The boy was only cold, tired, and frightened. It could have been far worse, and he knew it. He had been very glad to see Richard appear and held him tightly around the neck all the way home. There were any number of ways to die out in the woods. Richard had heard of people attacked by a bear or a cougar or bitten by a snake, but he couldn't imagine what had killed Victor's men. He'd never seen anything like it. He knew it hadn't been soldiers. He supposed that it could have been the gifted using some kind of terrible power to slaughter the men, but he just didn't think that was the explanation. He realized then that he was already thinking of it as a beast. Whatever killed the men, Richard had taken precautions as they had set out. He followed shallow streams until they were a good distance from the site of the slaughter. He was careful to lead them up out of the rushing water and away from the stream across ground where it would be much more difficult to track them. More than once throughout the day, he had led them over bare rock or through water to make it extremely time-consuming for someone good at tracking to follow them. The shelter, too, was designed to blend into the surrounding woods. It would be hard to spot unless someone passed very near to it. Victor dragged a heavy load of balsam boughs close and laid them at Richard's feet.
Need more?
With the toe of his boot, Richard nudged the pile, judging by its density how much and how well it would cover the remaining poles. No, I think these and the ones Nikki is bringing should be enough. Nikki dropped her load beside Victor's. It seemed odd to him seeing Nikki doing such work. Even dragging balsam boughs, she had a regal look about her. While Kara was a strikingly beautiful woman as well, her audacious bearing made it seem rather natural for her to be building a shelter, or a spiked flail cocked to kill intruders. Nikki, though, looked unnatural working in the woods, as if she would complain about getting her hands dirty, although she never once did. It wasn't that she was at all unwilling to do whatever Richard needed her to do, it was just that she looked completely out of place doing it. She simply had a noble bearing that seemed too stately for the task of hauling branches for a shelter in the woods. Now that she had brought all the balsam boughs that Richard needed, Nikki stood quietly under the dripping trees, hugging herself as she shivered. Richard's fingers were numb with cold as he quickly wove on the remaining boughs. He saw Kara, as she worked to secure the limbs, occasionally putting her hands under her armpits. Only Victor showed no outward appearance of being cold. Richard imagined that the blacksmith's glower was enough to warm him most of the time.
"Why don't you three get some sleep?" Victor said as Richard placed the last of the boughs over the shelter. "I'll take watch for now if no one objects. I'm not much sleepy."
From the undercurrent of anger in the man's voice, Richard imagined that Victor might not be sleepy for quite a long while. He could certainly understand Victor's bitter sorrow. The man would no doubt spend his watch trying to think of what he would say to Farron's mother and the relatives of the other men. Richard laid an understanding hand on Victor's shoulder. "We don't know what we're up against, Don't hesitate to wake us if you hear or see anything at all unusual. And don't forget to come inside and have your share of sleep. Tomorrow will be a long day of traveling. We all need to be strong. Victor nodded. Richard watched as the blacksmith picked up his cloak and threw it around his shoulders before seizing roots and clinging vines to help him scale the rock above the shelter to where he would watch over them. Richard wondered if perhaps the outcome might have been different had Victor been with the men. Then he thought about the aftermath of splintered trees, deep gouges in the ground carved with such force that it had overturned rocks and torn thick roots apart. He remembered the ripped leather armor, the shattered bones, the rent bodies, and was glad that Victor had not been with the men when the attack had come. Even a heavy mace wielded in anger by the powerful arms of the master blacksmith would not have stopped whatever had come into that clearing. Nikki pressed a hand to Richard's forehead, testing for fever.
You need to rest. No watch for you tonight. The three of us will each take a turn.
Richard wanted to argue, but he knew that she was right. This was not a battle he should take up, so he didn't, and instead nodded his agreement. Kara, obviously prepared to take Nikki's side if he argued, turned back from watching them from out of the small opening between the boughs. From the gathering darkness all around, a grating sound had begun to build into a shrill chirr. Now that they were finished with the effort of building the shelter, the noise was hard to ignore. It made the whole forest seem alive with raucous activity. Nikki finally took notice of it and paused to look around. She frowned.
What is that sound, anyway?
Richard plucked an empty skin from a tree trunk. Everywhere throughout the forest, the trees were covered with the pale, tannish, thumb-sized husks.
Cicadas?
Richard smiled to himself as he let the gossamer ghost of the creature that had once lived inside roll into his palm. This is what's left after they molt. Nikki glanced at the empty skin in his hand and briefly looked at some of the others clinging to the trees.
While I spent most of my life in towns and cities and indoors, I've spent a great deal of time outdoors since leaving the Palace of the Prophets. These insects must be unique to these woods. I don't recall ever seeing them before or hearing them.
You wouldn't have. I was a boy the last time I saw them.
This kind of cicada emerges from underground every 17 years. Today is the first day they all have begun to emerge. They will only be around for a few weeks while they mate and lay their eggs. Then we won't see them again for another 17 years.
Really?
Kara asked as she poked her head back out. Every 17 years? She thought it over for a moment and then scowled up at Richard.
They better not keep us awake.
Because of their numbers, they create quite an unforgettable sound. With countless of the cicadas all trilling together, you can sometimes hear the harmonic rise and fall of their song moving through the forest in a wave. In the quiet of the night, their stridulation may seem deafening at first, but believe it or not, it will actually lull you to sleep. Satisfied to know that the noisy insects would not keep her charge awake, Kara disappeared back inside. Richard recalled his wonder when Zed had walked with him through the woods, showing him the newly emerged creatures, telling him all about their 17-year life cycle. To Richard, as a boy, it was a memorable wonder. Zed told him how he would be grown up when they came again, that he had first seen them as a boy, and the next time he would see them as a grown man. Richard remembered marveling at the event and promising himself that when they came again, he would be sure to spend more time watching the rare creatures when they appeared from the ground. Richard felt a wave of profound sadness for the loss of that innocent time in life. As a boy, the emergence of the cicadas had seemed like just about the most amazing phenomenon he could imagine, and waiting 17 years until they returned seemed like the hardest thing he would ever have to do. And now they were back. And now he was a man. He cast the empty husk aside. After Richard removed his wet cloak and crawled in behind Nikki, he pulled branches together to cover over the opening to the snug shelter. The thick branches toned down the high-pitched song of the cicadas. The ceaseless buzzing was making him sleepy. He was pleased to see that the balsam boughs worked to shed the rain, leaving the cave-like refuge dry if not warm. They had laid down a bed of boughs over the exposed ground, so they would have a relatively soft and dry platform upon which to sleep. Even without rain dripping on them, though, the humidity and fog still dampened everything. Their breath came out in ephemeral clouds. Richard was weary of being wet. Handling trees had left him covered with bark and needles and dirt. His hands were sticky from tree sap. He couldn't remember ever being so miserable with grime and grit clinging to his wet skin and wet clothes. At least the pine and balsam pitch left the shelter smelling pleasant. He wished he could have a hot bath. He hoped that Kalin was warm and dry and unharmed. Tired as he was and sleepy as the sound of the cicadas was making him, there were things Richard needed to know. There were matters far more important to him than sleep or his simple boyhood wonder. He needed to find out what Nicky knew about what had killed Victor's men. There were too many connections to ignore. The attack had come right near where Richard, Kalin, and Kara had been camped a few days before. More importantly, whatever had killed the men didn't seem to have left any tracks, at least none that he had been able to find in his brief search. And, other than that displaced rock, Richard couldn't find any tracks from either Kalin or her abductor. Richard intended, before he slept, to find out what Nicky knew about what had killed the men. Chapter 8. Richard untied the leather thongs beneath his pack and opened his bedroll, spreading it out in the narrow space left between the other two. "Nicky, back at the place where the men were killed, you said that it had been a blood frenzy." He leaned back against the rock wall underneath the overhang. "What did you mean?" Nicky folded herself into a sitting position to his right, atop her own bedroll. "What we saw back there wasn't simply killing. Isn't that obvious?" He supposed she had a point. He had never witnessed a scene so shaped by rage. He was well aware, though, that she knew far more about it. Kara curled up to his left. "I'm telling you," she said to Nicky, "I don't think he knows." Richard cast a leery gaze at the moored Sith and then at the sorceress. "Knows what?" Nicky ran her fingers back through her wet hair, pulling strands off her face. She looked a little puzzled. "You said that you got the letter I sent."
"I did."
It had been quite a while back. He tried to remember through the days of weariness and worry everything Nicky's letter had said, something about Jigang creating weapons out of people. "Your letter was valuable in helping figure out what was happening at the time, and I did appreciate your warning about Jigang's darker pursuits of creating weapons out of the gifted." "Nicholas the Slide was a nasty piece of work."
"Nicholas."
Nicky spat the name before wrapping a blanket around her shoulders. "He is but a flea on the rump of the wolf." If Nicholas was the flea, Richard hoped never to run into the wolf. Nicholas the Slide had been a wizard whom the Sisters of the Dark had altered to have abilities that were well beyond any human traits. It had been thought that accomplishing such conjuring with people was not only a lost art, but impossible because, among other things, such nefarious work required the use of not only additive but subtractive magic. While a rare few had learned to manipulate it, until Richard's birth there hadn't been anyone born with the actual gift for subtractive magic in thousands of years. But there had been those who, even though they had not been born with that side of the gift, still managed to gain the use of subtractive magic. Darkin Rall had been one such person. It was said that he had traded the pure souls of children to the Keeper of the Underworld in exchange for dark indulgences, including the ability to use subtractive magic. Richard supposed that it could also have been through morbid promises to the Keeper that the first Sisters of the Dark had contrived to obtain the knowledge of how to use subtractive magic, thereafter passing it on in secret to their covert disciples. When the Palace of the Prophets had fallen, Jigang had captured many of the Sisters, both Sisters of the Light and Sisters of the Dark, but their numbers were dwindling. From what Richard had learned, the Dreamwalker's ability enabled him to enter every part of a person's mind and thereby control them. There was no private thought he did not know or intimate deed he could not witness. It was an inner violation so complete that no hidden corner of the mind was safe from the Dreamwalker's direct scrutiny. What was worse, the victim could not always tell if Jigang was lurking there, in their mind, witness to their most secret thoughts. Nikki had said that the haunting possession by the dreamwalker had driven a few of the sisters mad. Richard also knew that through that link Jigang could measure out excruciating pain and, if he wished it, death. With such control, the dreamwalker could make the sisters do anything he wished. Through an ancient magic created by one of Richard's ancestors to protect his people from the dreamwalkers of that time, those who swore fidelity to the Lord Rall were protected. Along with the rest of his gift, Richard had inherited that bond and, with a dreamwalker again born into the world, it now safeguarded those loyal to him from Jigang stealing into their minds and enslaving them. While a formal devotion was spoken by the people of Dahara to their Lord Rall, the protection that the bond provided was actually invoked through the conviction of the person bonded, through their doing what they thought was called for by their fidelity. Both Anne, the prelate of the Sisters of the Light, and Verna, the woman Anne had named as her successor, had stolen into the Imperial Order's camp and tried to rescue their sisters. The captive sisters had been offered the protection of the bond. All they had to do was accept in their hearts their loyalty to Richard. But most were so terrified of Jigang that more than once they had refused their chance at freedom. Not everyone was willing to embrace liberty. Liberty required not just effort, but risk. Some people chose to delude themselves and see their chains as protective armor. Nikki had once been in servitude to the Fellowship of the Order, the Sisters of the Light, and then the Sisters of the Dark, and finally to Jigang. She no longer was. She had instead embraced Richard's love of life. Her steadfast loyalty to him and what he believed in had freed her from the clutches of the Dreamwalker. But far more than that, it had freed her from the yoke of servitude she had worn her whole life. Her life was now hers alone. He thought that maybe that might have something to do with the resolute nobility of her bearing. "I didn't read the whole letter," Richard admitted. "Before I was able to finish it, we were attacked by men that Nicholas had sent to capture us. I told you about it before. That was when Sabar was killed. During that fight, the letter fell into the fire." Nikki slouched back. "Dear spirits," she murmured, "I thought you knew." Richard was tired and at the end of his patience. "Knew what?" Nikki let her arms slip to her sides. She looked up at him in the dim light and let out a frazzled sigh. "Jigang found a way for the Sisters of the Dark he holds captive to use their ability to begin creating weapons out of people, as had been done during the Great War. In many ways, he is a brilliant man. He makes it his business to learn. He collects books from the places he sacks. I've seen some of those books. Among all sorts of tomes, he has ancient handbooks of magic from around the time of the Great War. The problem is, while he may be a dreamwalker and brilliant in certain areas, he does not have the gift, and so his understanding of it, of exactly what Han is and how this force of life functions, is crude at best. It's not easy for one without magic to comprehend such things. You have the gift, and yet even you don't really understand it or know very much about how it works. But because Jigang doesn't know how to work magic, he blunders around demanding that things be done simply because he has dreamed them up, because he is the great emperor, and he wishes his visions to be brought to life." Richard rubbed his fingers back and forth on his brow, rolling off the dirt. "Don't sell him short in that regard. It's possible that he knows more about what he's doing than you realize."
"What do you mean?"
"I may not know a lot about the subject of magic, but one of the things I have learned is that magic can also be thought of much like an art form. Through artistic expression, for lack of a better term, magic that has never been before can be created." Nikki stared in astonished disbelief.
"Richard, I don't know where you could have heard such a thing, but it just doesn't work that way."
I know. Kaelin thinks I'm out on a limb with this one, too. Having been raised around wizards, she knows a lot about magic, and in the past, she has flatly insisted that I'm wrong, but I'm not. I've done it before. Using the gift in such a way, in new and original ways,
got me out of what would otherwise have been unbreakable traps.
Nicky was peering at him in that analytical way of hers. He suddenly realized why. It wasn't only what he'd said about magic. He was talking about Kaylin again. The woman who did not exist. The woman he had dreamed.
Kara's expression betrayed her mute concern.
Anyway, Richard said, getting back to the crux of the matter, just because Jigang doesn't have the gift doesn't mean he can't still dream up things, dream up nightmares like Nicholas. It is through such original conceptualization that the most deadly things for which there may be no conventional counter are created. I suspect that this may have been the method those wizards in ancient times used for creating weapons out of people in the first place.
Nicky was beside herself with bottled agitation. Richard, magic just doesn't work like that. You can't dream up whatever you'd like to have, wish for what you want. Magic functions by the laws of its nature, just like all other things in the world. Whim will not make boards out of trees. You must cut the trees to the desired form. If you want a house, you can't wish up bricks and boards to stack themselves into a dwelling. You must use your hands to craft the structure.
Richard leaned toward the sorceress.
Yes, but it's the human imagination that makes those concrete actions not just possible, but effective. Most builders think in terms of houses or barns. They do what's been done before simply because that was what was done before. Much of the time they don't want to think, so they never envision anything more. They limit themselves to repetition, and as an excuse they insist that it must be done that way because it has always been done that way. Most magic is like that, the gifted simply repeating what has already been done before, believing that it must be done that way with no more justification than that it has always been done that way. Before a grand palace can be built, it first has to be imagined by someone bold enough to have a vision of what could be. A palace will not spontaneously spring forth to the surprise of all while men are attempting to build a barn. Only the conscious act of conceptualization can bring about the reality. For that act of creative imagination to bring about the existence of a palace, it cannot violate any of the laws of the nature of the things that are used. On the contrary, the person who imagines a grand palace with the goal of seeing it built must be intimately aware of the nature of all the things he will use in the construction. If he isn't, the palace will fall down. He must know the nature of the materials better than the man who uses them to build a simple barn. It's not a matter of wishing for something that transcends the laws of nature, but a matter of original thinking based on those laws of nature. I grew up in the woods around Heartland, never having seen a palace.
Richard spread his arms, as if to show her the things he had seen since leaving his homeland.
Until I saw the castle at Tamarang, the wizard's keep in the confessor's palace in Adendril, or the people's palace in Dahara, I never imagined that such places existed, or even that they could exist. They were beyond the scope of my thinking at the time. And yet, even though I never imagined that such places could be built, other men thought them up, and they were built. I think that one of the important functions of grand creations is that they inspire people.
Nicky appeared not only to be swept up in his explanation, but to be considering his words with serious interest.
Do you mean to say, then, that you think an art form can also shape such important things as the function of magic?
Richard smiled. Nicky, you could not grasp the importance of life until I carved the statue back in Altarang. When you saw the concept in tangible form, you were able at last to put together all the things you had learned throughout your life and finally grasp its meaning. An artistic creation touched your soul. That's what I mean about an important function of great works, is that they inspire people. Because it inspired you with the beauty of life, with the nobility of man, you acted to become free, something you had never thought was possible. Because the people of Altarang as well could see in that statue what could and should be, they were stirred to stand up to the tyranny crushing their lives, It was not accomplished by copying other statues, by doing what was the accepted norm for statues in the old world of showing man as weak and ineffective, but by an idea of beauty, a vision of nobility that shaped what I carved. I didn't violate the nature of the marble I used, but rather I used the nature of the stone to accomplish something different than what others routinely did with it. I studied the properties of stone, I learned how to work it, and I sought to understand what more I could do with it in order to bring about my objective. I had Victor make me the finest tools that would enable me to do the work in the way it needed to be done. In that way, I brought to reality what I wanted to create, what had never been before. I think that magic can work this way as well. I believe that such original ideas played a part in how weapons were once created out of people. After all, when such weapons were made, they were effective in large part because they were original, because they had never been thought of or seen before. In many instances, the other side in the war then had to work to create entirely new things out of magic that were able to counter those weapons. In many cases, they were able to render the weapon obsolete by creating a counter magic, and then someone on the other side immediately went to work thinking up some new horror. If using magic creatively was not possible, then how did the wizards of old create weapons with it? You can't say they simply got the knowledge from a book or from past experience. Where and how would the first such weapons have originated if not with an original idea? Someone had to have used magic creatively in the first place. I think that Jigang is again doing this very thing with magic. He has studied some of what was done in the Great War, what weapons were created, and learned from that. He sometimes may direct that what was once created be created again, such as with Nicholas, but in other instances I think he imagines what has never been, what goes beyond what has been done before, and has it brought to reality by those who know how to use magic to build what he wants. In these acts of creation, it isn't the work that is the most remarkable aspect, but the idea and vision that makes the labor effective. Just as carpenters and bricklayers who built houses and barns can be employed to construct a palace. It wasn't so much their labor that was remarkable in the creation of palaces, but the act of insight and creation that gave it direction. Nikki nodded ever so slightly in concentration as she weighed his words.
I can see that your notion isn't at all the wild idea I thought it was at first. This is a line of reasoning that I've never encountered. I'll have to think about the possibilities. You may be the first to really understand the mechanism behind Jigang's scheme, or for that matter, behind the creations of wizards in ancient times. This would explain a great many things that have nagged at me over the years.
Nikki's words were spoken with intellectual respect for a concept new to her, but a concept she fully grasped. No one who had ever spoken to Richard about magic had ever treated his ideas with such an insightful understanding. He felt as if this was the first time anyone had truly understood what he saw. "Well," he said, "I've had to deal with Jigang's creations. Like I said, Nicholas was a great deal of trouble." In the dim light, Nikki studied his face for a moment.
"Richard, from what I was able to find out," she said in a soft voice, "Nicholas was not Jigang's actual goal. Nicholas was merely practice."
"Practice?" Richard thumped his head back against the wall. "I don't know, Nikki. I'm not so sure about that. Nicholas the Slide was a formidable creation and one nasty piece of work. You don't know the trouble he caused us." Nikki shrugged.
"You defeated him."
Richard blinked in astonishment. "You make it sound like he was just a bump in the road. He wasn't, I'm telling you. He was a frightening creation who nearly killed us."
Nikki slowly shook her head. "And I'm telling you, as formidable as he may have been, Nicholas was not what Jigang was after. You told me not to sell the Dreamwalker short. Don't you now do the same thing? He never thought Nicholas was fully your match. What you say about the process of imagination in creating new things actually makes sense, especially in this instance. It may even explain a few things. From the little I was able to learn, I believe that from the beginning Nicholas was only meant to expand the skills of the sisters that Jigang had assigned to the task of creating weapons. Nicholas was not Jigang's objective, but simply practice on the way to that objective. With his dwindling number of sisters, that practice has gained a new urgency. Even so, he apparently has enough sisters for the work of creating his weapons. Richard felt goosebumps tingling up his arms as he began to realize the full implications of what Nicky was telling him. You mean to say that in creating Nicholas, it was like Jigang was just having his carpenters build a house as practice before he sends them on to build something vastly more complicated, like a palace? Nicky looked up at him and smiled. Yes, that's it, exactly. But he sent Nicholas with troops to govern a land as well as to capture us. A mere matter of convenience. Jigang had instilled in Nicholas a need to hunt you, but only as part of the testing for his greater goals. He didn't really expect the slide to be able to accomplish his transcendent ambitions. The Emperor may hate you for impeding his progress in conquering the new world. He may consider you unworthy as an opponent, and he may deem you an immoral heathen worthy only of death. But he's smart enough to give you credit for your ability. It's like when you said that you sent that captured soldier to assassinate Jigang. You didn't really expect that lone soldier to succeed at the difficult task of assassinating a well-guarded emperor. But the soldier was of no other value to you, and since you thought that there was at least a chance that he might accomplish something, you might as well send him on the mission while you worked on far better ideas that you expected to have a more reasonable chance of success. And if the soldier was killed, then that was fine by you because he only got what was coming to him anyway. Nicholas was like that. He was a conjured creation, practice along the path to something altogether superior. In the scheme of things, Nicholas wasn't all that valuable to Jigang, so Jigang, instead of having him killed, used him. If Nicholas succeeded, then Jigang would be ahead of the game, and if you killed him, then you did him a service. Richard ran his hand back over his hair. He felt overwhelmed at the implications. He had criticized Nicky for not being open to seeing the larger picture, and here he had just been guilty of doing the same thing. Well then, he asked her, what do you think Jigang might conjure up that's worse than Nicholas the Slide? The drone of the cicada seemed oppressive, invasive at that moment, as if they were the enemy surrounding him. I believe he has forged ahead and already created such a masterwork, Nicky said with quiet finality. She pulled her blanket up around her shoulders and held it closed at her throat. I think that's what those men back there in the woods faced. Richard watched her expression in the near darkness. What do you know about what Jigang has done? Not a great deal, Nicky admitted. Only a few words whispered as one of my former fellow sisters was leaving on a journey.
A journey?
To the world of the dead. By her tone of voice and the way she stared off, Richard didn't want to ask what had brought about the woman's travel plans. So what did she tell you? Nicky let out a weary sigh. That Jigang had been making things from the lives of captives and volunteers both. Some of those young wizards actually think they are sacrificing themselves for a greater good. Nicky shook her head at such a sad delusion. The sister was the one who told me that Nicholas was but a stepping stone to His Excellency's true and noble ends. Nicky looked up again to make sure that Richard was paying attention. She said that Jigang was on the brink of creating a creature similar to one he had found in ancient writings, but far better, far more deadly and invincible. The hair at the back of Richard's neck lifted.
A creature? What kind of creature?
A beast. An invincible beast. Richard swallowed at the baleful sound of the word.
What's this creature do? Were you able to find out? What's its nature?
For some reason, he just couldn't seem to bring himself to use the same word aloud right then, as if speaking it might summon it from out of the surrounding night. Nicky's troubled eyes turned away. As
As the sister slipped into the arms of death, she smiled like the keeper himself with a booty of souls and said, "Once he uses his power, the beast will at last know Richard Rawl. Then it will find him and kill him. His life, like mine, is finally at its end." Richard made himself blink.
"Did she say anything else?"
Nikki shook her head. At that point, she convulsed in the agony of death. The room went black as the keeper snatched her soul in payment for bargains she had once struck. "The one thing that's been troubling me is how this creature found us. Still, I don't think the situation is as desperate as it may seem. There is really no conclusive evidence to make us believe that it really was this beast that attacked the men back there. After all, you haven't used your power, so there wouldn't have been any way for Jigang's beast to find you."
Richard looked down at his boots.
"When the soldiers attacked," he said in a low voice as he rubbed a finger along the edge of the leather sole, "I used my gift to deflect the arrows. I didn't do so well with the last one."
"Lord Rawl," Kara said, "I don't think that's true. I think you used your sword to deflect the arrows."
"You weren't there right then, so you didn't see what was happening," Richard said as he grimly shook his head. "I was using my sword on the soldiers. I couldn't use it to deflect the dozens of arrows as well. I deflected the arrows with my gift."
Nikki was now sitting up straight.
"You used your gift? How did you summon it?"
Richard shrugged self-consciously. He wished he knew more about what he'd done.
"Through need, I guess. I didn't know I would end up being responsible."
She gently touched his arm.
"Don't foolishly blame yourself. You had no way to know. Had you not done as you did, you would have been killed. You were acting to save your own life. You didn't know anything about the beast. More than that, though, you may not be entirely responsible."
Richard frowned at her. "What do you mean?"
Nikki sank back against the rock wall. "I fear that I may have contributed to its finding us."
"You? But how?"
"I used subtractive magic to get rid of your blood so I could heal you. While the sister didn't say anything specific that I could point to, I still got the uneasy feeling that this creature may somehow be tied to the underworld. If that's true, then when I got rid of your blood with the use of subtractive magic, I may have inadvertently given it a taste of your blood, so to speak."
"You did the right thing," Kara said. "You did the only thing you could do. To let Lord Rawl die instead would have been handing Jigang what he sought."
Nikki nodded her appreciation of Kara's words. Richard let out the breath he had been holding.
"What else can you tell me about this thing?"
"Nothing of any consequence, I'm afraid. The sister told me that the sisters who were experimenting with creating weapons out of people had only created Nicholas to work out some of the preliminary details before moving on to their important work. Even so, some of them died in the task of conjuring the slide, and with as many as have already died, Jigang is getting to the point where he has few to spare. He has used those he still has, while he still has enough, to accomplish his goal. Apparently, creating the beast was vastly more complex and difficult than creating a slide. But the results were said to have been worth it. I suspect that along the way, he may have directed that shortcuts be taken, shortcuts that involve the underworld. If we're going to fight this thing, we need to find out everything we can about this beast, and we need to find out before it catches us. With what happened to the men, I don't think we have much time."
Richard knew that what she meant but hadn't said was that she wanted him to forget what she thought were his meaningless dreams about Kalin and to put his full concentration and effort toward this dangerous creation of Jigang's. "I have to find Kalin," he said in a quiet tone meant to convey his conviction and his resolve.
"You can't do anything if you're dead," Nikki said. Richard lifted the baldric over his head. He leaned the polished scabbard, holding the Sword of Truth against the rock.
"Look, we're not even sure that whatever killed those men back there really is this beast you're talking about."
"What do you mean?" Nikki asked.
"Well, if it can find me when I use my gift, then why did it attack the men? Sure, it was the place where I'd used my ability, but the attack was 3 days after the fact.
If it was supposed to know me after I used my power, then why attack the men?
Maybe it just thought you were among them, Kara offered.
Nikki nodded.
Kara might be right.
Maybe, Richard said. But if it recognized me by me using my gift, and in addition you gave it a taste of my blood, then wouldn't it know that I wasn't among the men?
Nikki shrugged. I don't know. It very well could be that by using your gift you only summoned it to the general area. But when you stopped using your ability, then the beast was blind to you, so to speak. Maybe it was so angry that it just missed you, it went into a frenzy of killing whoever was there.
If that's true, then I would suspect that it needs you to again use your gift, now that it's close, to finally be able to catch you.
But she said that once I used my gift, it would know me. That doesn't sound to me like I need to use it again for it to find me.
Maybe it does now know you, Nikki said, but maybe it still needs to find you. Since it knows you, now maybe all the beast needs is for you to again use your gift so that it can pounce.
That had a frightening kind of logic to it.
I guess it's good that I don't depend on my gift.
You'd better make sure you let us protect you, Kara said. I don't think you would better do anything that might even inadvertently cause you to use your magic.
I'm afraid that I agree with Kara, Nikki said. I'm not sure about it having a taste of your blood. But the one thing we do know for sure is what the sister told me, that if you use your gift, it will find you. As long as the beast is hunting you, and until we can learn more about it and nullify the threat, you must not use your gift for any reason.
Richard conceded with a nod. He didn't know if that was possible. While he didn't know how to call upon his gift, he wasn't sure that he knew how to prevent it coming forth either. It was awakened by anger and answered a certain kind of need. He wasn't aware of the specific conditions that invoked his ability. It just happened. While their theory of not using his gift made sense, he wasn't sure he could actually control it enough to prevent it if conditions caused it to spring to life. Another frightening thought occurred to him. It was possible that the beast had found him and knew precisely where he was, and it had only killed the men out of bloodlust. For all he knew, the beast could be out in the woods watching, using the noise of the cicadas to cover its footsteps as it approached their shelter. In the dim light, Nikki watched him. As he pondered the grim possibilities, she reached out again and felt his forehead. Drawing back, she said,
"We'd better get some rest. You're shivering with the cold. I'm afraid that in your condition you may lapse into a fever. Lie down. We'll all have to keep each other warm, but first you need to be dry, or you'll never get warm."
Kara leaned past Richard toward Nikki. "How do you think you can get him dry without a fire?"
Nikki gestured. "Both of you, lie back."
Richard lay back. Kara hesitantly complied. Nikki leaned over them, placing a hand just above their heads. Richard felt the warm tingle of magic, but not an uncomfortable sensation like the last time. He could see the soft glow above Kara as well. It struck him how remarkable it was for Nikki to trust Kara enough to use her magic on her. Using magic on a moored Sith gave them the opportunity to seize that magic in order to control the gifted person. Richard found it even more remarkable that Kara would trust Nikki enough to allow her to use magic on her. Mord Sith did not like magic one bit. Nikki's hands moved slowly downward, just above their bodies. By the time she reached Richard's boots, he realized that he felt dry. He ran a hand over his shirt, then his pants, and found that they were both dry.
"How is that?" Nikki asked.
Kara was scowling. "I'd rather be wet." Nikki arched an eyebrow.
"I can arrange that if you like."
Kara put her hands under her arms to warm them and remained silent. Satisfied that Richard was pleased, Nikki did the same for herself, moving both hands down her dress as if slowly pressing away the water. When she finished, she was shivering and her teeth were chattering, but she and her black dress were dry. Concerned by the way she wavered that she might pass out, Richard sat up and gently gripped her arm.
Are you all right?
I'm just exhausted, she admitted. I've not had much sleep for days, on top of the effort of healing you and then the exertion of the traveling we did after the attack today. I'm afraid that it's all caught up with me. This bit of magic took what strength and warmth I had left. I just need to get some sleep, that's all. But even if you don't realize it, Richard, you need it even more. Lie back and sleep now, please. If we all lie close, we can keep each other warm.
Dry, but weary and still cold, Richard wriggled into his bedroll. She was right, he did need rest. He couldn't get help for Kalyn if he wasn't rested. Without hesitation, Kara pressed up close on his left to help get him warm. Nikki pushed in on his other side. The warmth was a relief. He hadn't realized how cold he was until the three of them crowded in tight together. He knew by how he felt that Nikki was right, that he wasn't fully well yet. At least he only needed rest and not magic.
Do you think this beast could have taken Kalyn in order to get to me? He asked into the dark and quiet shelter. Nikki was a moment in answering.
Such a creature needs no perverse method to get to you, Richard. From what the sister said and from what I fear I may have done, to say nothing of you having used your gift, the beast will be able to find you. From all those dead men back there, I fear it already has.
Richard felt the weight of guilt crushed down upon him. If not for him, those men would be alive. He had difficulty swallowing past the lump in his throat. He wished there were some way to undo what was done, some way to give them their lives and their futures back.
Lord Rawl, Kara whispered, I would like to make a confession, if you will swear never to repeat it.
Richard had never heard her say such an odd thing. All right. What is it that you wish to confess? Her answer was a while in coming, and then it was so soft he would not have been able to hear it were she not so close.
I'm afraid.
Almost against his better judgment, Richard lifted his arm around her shoulders and held her close. Don't be. It's coming after me, not you. She lifted her head and scowled at him.
That is the reason I'm afraid. After seeing what it did to those men, I'm afraid that it's coming for you and there is nothing I can do to protect you.
Oh, Richard said. Well, if it makes you feel any better, I'm afraid of that too. Kara laid her head back down on his shoulder, content to stay under the protective comfort of his arm. The surrounding strum of the cicadas somehow made him feel more vulnerable. The 17-year cycle of the insects was inescapable, inexorable, unstoppable. So was Jigang's beast. How could he hide from such a thing?
So, Nikki asked, apparently trying to lighten the somber mood in the shelter, where did you meet this woman of your dreams?
Richard didn't know if she was trying to soften the question with a little humor, or if she was being sarcastic. If he didn't know better, he would have thought it sounded like jealousy. He stared up in the darkness as he thought back to that day. I was out in the woods looking for evidence of who had killed my father, the man I grew up thinking was my father, George Cipher, the man who'd raised me. That was when I spotted Kalyn moving along a trail around Trunt Lake. Four men were following her. They were assassins sent by Darkin Rawl to kill her. He had already killed all the other confessors. She is the last.
This is the end of disc number 3. Please insert disc number 4.